Oh, hello, you paltry, salty Garibaldis. Welcome to week number 12 of the Blind Buy podcast. We are still number one in the podcast charts because of the actions of you glorious cans. Because of your actions, because of you liking the podcast and leaving some delicious, delectable reviews. Reviews so mouth-watering that I want to fry them in batter and eat them with a yard of cod. Thank you for those lovely, delicious reviews. My tummy is full from all of those reviews. I am satiated. But I'll be hungry again. So please leave more reviews on the podcast and rate it highly and like it. And tell a friend, tell a postman about it. Tell an undertaker. Tell us a steeplechaser. Tell a wagon driver that he needs to subscribe to this podcast. For it will fill holes in his soul that he did not know existed. Tell the postman about your podcast hug and see if he doesn't get creeped out. Tell him about the man from Limerick that talks into your ear about love and life. And then stare him straight into the eye as you receive your parcel or your BART if you live in the Gaeltacht. Shout out to all the boys in Connemara, the recipients of BART. Non-stop BART over there. Parcels, parcels, parcels. All day. What did we talk about last week? Last week I didn't give you a full proper podcast because I was under the weather. I was ill. I had a little hint of a sore throat and a runny nose and an old small bit of a chest. Fairly standard flu situation, but which was grand. But a flu is not conducive to recording pleasurable podcasts. So I give you a short story instead. And this short story was called Hugged Up Studded Blood Puppet, which is one of my favourite short stories from the book that I wrote, because it's the most cinematic. When I was writing it, I fully felt like I was watching a film in my head. I could see how it was lit and I could see how it was going to be filmed and all this stuff. And I really enjoyed writing that story and I quite liked the plot and I would love to turn that story into a screenplay of some description. And it ironically, it ended up half predicting that mad film that came out there on Netflix, The Foreigner, where Pierce Brosnan plays Gerry Adams and Jackie Chan is a kung fu man from China who has to fight the IRA and has to fight Gerry Adams. And I ended up ironically predicting that film in that story, Hugged Up Studded Blood Puppet, with a fictional film in the story called Black 47 Triad Paddy. But I liked writing it, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Oh yes, an award was won during the week. Eason's had a poll of the readers' favourite books of 2017, and The Gospel According to Blind Buy was voted Eason's readers' favourite book of 2017. So if you are an Eason's reader and you voted in that, thank you very much. I mean, it's nice to get an award. The other thing as well, you know, a couple of podcasts ago I spoke about, you know, when it comes to maintaining my creative vigour, it's very important for me to not take positive criticism or negative criticism on board. Not positive criticism. Not to take praise on board and not to take negative criticism on board. That's what I find in my experience. You gotta deflect both. You gotta deflect praise and you gotta deflect criticism. You must only create for you and for your own personal aesthetics. And when you start thinking about what other people like or what other people don't like, you lose your creative heart. So that's quite challenging because I'm happy to win that award and I'm proud of it. But at the same time, I have to kind of just very mindfully just kind of walk past it. I have to treat that award like a friendly dog. That, you know, I'm walking along on a path and it's a lovely day. And across the way, there's some begrudgers throwing shit at me. I have to just peacefully avoid their shit and walk on and ignore the shit that's been thrown. But also, this beautiful, friendly golden retriever comes up the pathway and his tail is wagging and his eyes have a sparkle in him. And he comes up with his lovely wet nose and places it in my palm and it feels exhilarating. And he wags his tail and looks at me and then jumps up and places his two paws on my chest and I give him a little hug. And that golden retriever, ladies and gentlemen, is that award. And I must give that golden retriever a gentle hug, a little pat on the head. But I can't feed him. I have to walk on. And that golden retriever will try and follow me. But I have to say, no, go home. And I carry on in my journey. And acknowledge that I've seen the golden retriever, but I must carry on forward. So that's how I treat positive praise. It's great. Golden retrievers are wonderful. Meeting a nice dog is a great experience. But, you know, you start throwing them treats, you start being too nice, then you're after kidnapping someone's dog, and that brings a whole load of shit on top of your life. In the same way that taking positive praise on board too much will destroy your creativity. Because, like I mentioned, that would mean that my locus of evaluation moves from being internal to external. And if you have an external locus of evaluation, if you value yourself, your value as a person, by an aspect of your behaviour, you will find yourself in a position of low self-esteem. And this period of low self-esteem will destabilise my mental health. And I'm sure you've heard me say that many a time. You'll probably notice from my voice that I'm still a little bit sick. And I'm not sick, I'm fully functional, I feel great. It's just, it feels like Serena Williams drove a tennis ball down my nose and it's politely lodged in the back of my throat. And I'm just kind of waiting for it to jettison during the night. So my voice is a little bit off, but it's grand. Small bit nasal. But being sick was, you know, it was nice. I don't get sick often. But sometimes getting sick can be, I don't know, it can give you a nice contemplative space. I'm quite driven all the time, you know. I like to keep myself busy and I don't relax a lot. I'm always doing something. But when you're struck down with an illness, you don't really have a choice. That's when you have to go, well, fuck it, I'm getting nothing done, so I'll watch a bit of Netflix or play a video game. That's what I did. I haven't played video games in about a year because my Xbox got the what's known as the red ring of death about a year and a half ago, where it just stops working and I didn't replace it. And this, I think this is a fantastic thing, because I think if I had an Xbox over the past year, a functional one, I don't know how much of that book I would have written. And I found this the past week. Now, I went and downloaded an absolutely beautiful game called Ori and the Blind Forest, which is, it's kind of a, it's a platform game in the way that Super Mario is, with a little bit of Echo the Dolphin. But it's a wonderful game. It's has a unreal soundtrack, and the story is beautiful. The design of it, the feel of it is very calming, you know. And the storyline, it rewards compassion. There's no such thing as a baddie in Ori and the Blind Forest, which I loved. In the storyline, who you believe to be your enemies, it always gives the backstory of the enemy and the pain behind why your enemy is acting like a dickhead. And I loved the game. I enjoyed it. I played it for about four days. I cleared it fully, and had a lovely experience. And I allowed myself this because I was sick. There was nothing else I was going to do. So it was like, drink a lot of tea, you know, take a bit of Sudafed, have a lot of oranges, and play a video game for 4 days. And I did it. and it was enjoyable. But however, and now I downloaded this onto my PC, that's what I did. I downloaded Steam, and I downloaded it from Steam. I didn't get my Xbox working, but I was gonna buy a new PlayStation or a new Xbox or something, and I'm not going to now, because what I realised is, because I have another book to write this year, you know, and I have a few other projects, quite demanding projects. And what I found with myself in video games, and I've realised it now, having been away from them for a year, even if I allow myself 1 hour a day, you know, because I'd be able to discipline myself around that, you know, 1 hour a day of video games, I personally think for me, right now I'm just speaking for myself, I think video games, they tick certain boxes in my mind that creativity usually tick. I found after playing a video game, it was kind of exciting the reward centers and pleasure centers of my brain. So that's what my mind kind of fixated on. It fixated on clearing this game, and it was like I downloaded my imagination into somebody else's imagination. So I don't think that I would have a creative incentive to be making short stories or coming up with ideas if I'm actively playing a video game, even if it's for an hour a day. So I'm not going to be buying a PlayStation anytime soon, not while I've got books to write. So that's a nice little observation I made as a result of that short bout of sore throatedness I had, whatever the fuck it was, or still is, yurt. And that process there that I described is, you know, you might have heard me before talking about emotional intelligence, and I use that as my part of my regime for my own mental hygiene, my mental health. That there is emotional intelligence in action. That's me mindfully and actively checking in with my emotions to see how I'm getting on, and to treat my life like I'm a scientist. So that's kind of what it is. If I'm generally very happy a lot of the time. You know, I said if I had to rate my happiness, I'm usually around an 8 out of 10. And a 10 would be when you receive some incredibly good news. So I'm pretty much very happy all the time, because I actively look after my mental health. When I feel myself getting irritated, angry with other people, angry with myself, then this takes me away from my happiness slightly. So when that happens, I bring in my emotional intelligence. I start asking myself, what changes in my life recently? What am I doing differently that might cause this very slight irritation? And for me, it was playing video games. It's like, well, okay, I'm feeling a bit irritated and I'm playing video games. Okay, maybe that's one of the reasons. Why is that? And I looked at it and it's like, yeah, it's giving me a sense of accomplishment when nothing real was actually accomplished. And that's, for me, as a creative person, that's not great. For you, it could be fine. Everybody's different, you know. Not everybody is into writing or into painting or making music. What it boils down to is personal meaning. Me, what gives me personal meaning is creating something. I know people and they get personal meaning from doing maths. Do you know, I've got buddies who would absolutely hate writing. They hate the written word. But the idea of balancing their own accounts, we'll say, even though they don't have to, would bring them an intense sense of calm and joy. So that's their personal meaning. And if I'm to, you know, we're after getting into 2018, people make New Year's resolutions. I would suggest to you a good New Year's resolution would be to find your sense of personal meaning. Find what is it in your own life that gives you that you really enjoy doing, that that thing that allows you to achieve what I've referred to as the state of flow, the state of intense and absolute concentration and happiness, whereby no worries are allowed in, no stress is allowed in. In very intense flow, even things like sexual desire and hunger aren't allowed in because you exist as a pure level of concentration. Try and find that thing in your life. It could be sports, it could be colouring in, do you know? In my book, I actually included a colouring in section for that reason, because some people might like to colour in. Doing the dishes, cleaning the garden, anything, you know? Counting coins, playing with a Japanese sand garden, I don't know. But importantly, you have to realise is that it definitely exists for you. If you don't know what it is yet, it is there, it is out there for you. And it depends on, you know, people who are introverted like myself, we kind of have it easier because we like to spend a lot of time by ourselves and to do little activities. But some people are extroverted. So extroverted people can find their flow in other people, in social situations, in a game of fucking cards. I don't know what extroverted people do because I'm so unbelievably introverted. But for flow to occur, the thing you must kind of look for, you have to seek out an activity that's voluntary, you know, no one's forcing you to do it, and it's enjoyable, it's motivational for the very sake of doing it. You know, a certain level of skill should be required in what you're doing, and there should be a bit of a challenge too, with goals towards success in it. But you should feel as though you have control and receive immediate feedback with some room for growth. And flow is characterized by, strangely, the complete lack of emotion when you're doing it. You have no sense of consciousness whatsoever. It just happens. We all experienced it when we were kids, whether we were playing with Lego or playing with crayons. And we tend to kind of drift out of the bit as we get older. For me, I experience flow as a waking state of dreaming. It's like dreaming, it's like controlling daydreams, but I'm autonomously controlling it, like I'm floating outside of myself. It's just a pure beam of energy. Sound like a lunatic now. But you might be asking, Blind Boy, why are you talking about flow again? You've spoken about flow in many podcasts. Well, the reason is, to be honest, is the field of positive psychology has found that flow is, there's a very definite link between contact with a flow state and continual levels of happiness. And it's not just modern psychology that found this. The ancient Chinese knew about this. Podcast a few weeks ago spoke about collectivism versus individualism and the holistic nature of collectivist thinking. Well, there was a Chinese philosopher, oh god, I'm going to try and pronounce his name, Zhuangzi, and he referred to flow as the ultimate happiness. Now this fella was knocking around fucking years ago, and he used to observe, he called it a stage of letting go, where when flow happens, you let go and you transcend your ego to become a kind of a pure energy, you know. But he saw flow in artisans, not necessarily in artists, in craftsmen and butchers. And I'm going to read a few excerpts now of this Zhuangzi and how he was observing a butcher in flow. And what he said was, at every touch of his hand, every heave of his shoulder, every move of his feet, every thrust of his knee, zip zoop, he slithered the knife along with a zing, and all was in perfect rhythm, as though he were performing the dance of the mulberry grove or keeping time with the Qing Shao music. I don't know what the fuck he's talking about there, but he's describing a butcher that he was watching who was in this intense land of skill and happiness. And when this Chinese philosopher went and actually spoke to the butcher and asked him, you know, what's the crack, what's going on, what's up with your technique, why are you so focused when you're slicing up an animal? And the butcher said, "What I care about is the way, which goes beyond skill. When I first began cutting up oxen, all I could see was the ox itself. After 3 years, I no longer saw the whole ox. And now I go at it by spirit and don't look with my eyes. Perception and understanding have come to a stop and spirit moves where it wants. However, when I come to a complicated place, I size up the difficulties, tell myself to watch out and be careful, keep my eyes on what I'm doing, work very slowly and move the knife with the greatest subtlety until flop, the whole thing comes apart like a cloud of earth crumbling to the ground. I stand there holding the knife and look all around me, completely satisfied and reluctant to move on, and then I wipe off the knife and put it away." So that's a Chinese butcher from a few hundred years ago describing to a philosopher his state of flow when he is practicing that thing that gives him a sense of meaning. And when I read that, it's like, yeah, that is identical to my own sense of flow when I'm writing a short story or writing a song or anything. It's a sense of doing something. When I write a story, it reveals itself to me. It happens in front of the page. And a huge story, 12,000 words, 16,000 words, an entire plot, fucking subplot, structure. I don't plan it out. It happens, it reveals itself like I'm watching a film in this intense state of concentration where I'm not even aware I'm writing a story. It's like I'm in a dream and it's just coming out. And like that butcher described, you know, when he comes to a difficult part in the meat, maybe a dodgy bone, and this challenge might engage the kind of the critical part of his brain that would take him out of flow, it doesn't happen. It's like he autonomously sizes up the difficulty and autonomously, without being aware of it, is cautious of it and manages to solve the problem while still in a state of flow. And that's the same with me when I'm writing. That's how I feel if I'm in a state of flow when I'm painting. Now, I haven't painted in 10 fucking years. I used to get a good, decent state of flow when I was painting. And then, like I said before, more rare in music. Musical flow for me is quite rare. When it does happen, I fucking nail it, but when it doesn't, I'm just kind of going through the motions. But if I sit down with a keyboard and write, I'm pretty much guaranteed flow 90% of the time. So for you in 2018, have a lash every day at finding that thing that gives you that sense of flow, that sense of happiness. And search through your childhood, because chances are you had it when you were a kid and you just, because of school or because of responsibilities or whatever, you stopped doing that thing that gave you flow. Probably because society said that it was silly and foolish and messy. You know, it could have been playing with Play-Doh. Like I mentioned Carl Jung a few weeks ago. Carl Jung used to go to the bottom of his garden and get his fucking knees muddy and play with sticks every day of his life until he was dead, an old man, because he understood for the importance of mental health and his own consciousness to be involved in play. And that's all he did. He just fucked around with mud and sticks, because that's what he did when he was 3 years of age, and it helped him to daydream. But if we take it to more modern times, modern psychology, the psychologist who is, I suppose, coined the term flow, and who is the leader of the field of positive psychology, is a lad called Csikszentmihalyi. Mad looking name. I think he's Croatian or Russian or something. But Csikszentmihalyi, in a bizarre case of synchronicity, one day he attended a lecture in Switzerland at this speaker. He didn't know who the speaker was. And this speech that he heard was so inspirational that he went off and founded the field of positive psychology and started to research into flow. The speaker, of course, was Carl Jung himself, and Csikszentmihalyi didn't know. But Csikszentmihalyi and positive psychology holds that happiness depends upon flow and how much flow that you can experience in your day-to-day life, depending on what it is, depending on your activity of personal meaning. And what Csikszentmihalyi identified as, you know, when you're looking at a candidate, an activity that could be a candidate for you to achieve flow, he has a diagram. And you must look for something that's both challenging and requires skill. Now, it can't be too challenging, because if it's too challenging, then you start to experience anxiety. And this anxiety will lead to self-criticism and frustration, and it will not get you the state of flow. It also has to require a certain level of skill, but not so much skill that you can't do it, because that too will lead to boredom and more anxiety. So it's about finding that happy ground where it's something that you're definitely handy at, definitely something that comes natural to you. And the more intensely that you kind of challenge yourself and use your skill and let the skill and challenge feed off each other, this gradually, like you're falling asleep, lulls you into what he calls the flow channel. And when you're in the flow channel, you're not aware of it, but you eventually move towards intense ecstasy and happiness. And this, you know, like meditation as well, if this is present in your life every single day, you will be a happy person, do you know, independent of external circumstances in a lot of cases. Csikszentmihalyi is highly critical of watching television and using social media. He believes that these practices lead to boredom and apathy, and stemming from that, frustration and anger. And me personally, you know, let's have some hot takes, why not? You know, I often wonder, I often use the field of positive psychology and flow psychology to wonder, is this apathy that social media can bring, is this why social media can be so toxic sometimes? When you're flying through your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed, when all of us, when any of us are doing it, you're very easily triggered into a extreme emotional response when you see something that we disagree with. You know, when you look at the comments under an article and you see someone and they're saying something you don't like, and you just get angry and want to call them a goal. Whereas this wouldn't happen if you were enjoying yourself. This would not happen in a state of flow. And I often wonder, is the apathy which is produced from these passive activities, does this feed into the toxicity of the social media environment? I wonder. I sound a bit like a Minions meme that your grandmother would share at that moment. But it is worth noting that social media is a toxic place where lovely, nice people can all of a sudden be transformed into quite hateful people who express very black and white, rigid and aggressive views. Because I refuse to believe that every horrible comment I read online. I know people who write horrible comments. I know them in real life, and I have pints with them, and they're just like me and you. They have their moments where they're angry, they have their moments where they're not angry, but I've seen people who write horrible things, spoken to them about it, and they're not filled with hate. They just were in that one moment in time. And that does give me a lot of hope, because the internet is a sewer and comment sections are a sewer. On the other side of the coin, I've spoken about the podcast hug, which is what I attempt to achieve with this podcast. I don't think podcasts produce apathy in the listener. I know from the responses that I get, I know myself from listening to podcasts, because I think podcasts require, they engage your ears only, and they require you to visualize with your mind. Reading does the same thing. Podcasts, to consume a podcast is quite participatory. scrolling through social media isn't really that participatory or watching television. It's being fed to you and you can sit back and, you know, you're like a goose that's having its liver fattened for foie gras. Don't know how to pronounce it. I've never eaten it. But podcasts don't do that. If when you're listening to this podcast, you know, I'd love to see someone's brain under a scanner listening to a podcast versus scrolling through Instagram. I think the podcast does ask more of you, the listener, and it's a more intense participatory experience where I won't say you experience flow while listening to a podcast, but it's not far off it. It's meditative and calming, and it's most certainly focused, and it's rejuvenating. And that's why people love podcasts. That's why I love podcasts when I listen to them. You feel good. You feel like you've done something good. You don't come away. You never come away sluggish from a podcast. You will come away sluggish from an hour of Facebook or an hour of video games, unfortunately. Maybe it's because of what it does to your eyes. It can be tiring on the eyes. But with a podcast, you can just lash in the earphones, go out for a nice walk. It'll reduce your breathing. And there is a little element of flow to a podcast, to appreciating one. I think maybe that's a hot, hot take. But you know what, lads? This is the place for hot takes. When I was describing that flow there, you know, I want to be cautious of when I say that something revealed itself on the page. There's a lot of writers out, not a lot of writers, but a few writers believe that, like, the universe has handed the story to them, which is bullshit. It's not the fucking universe. It's the product of your own unconscious mind in the same way that where dreams come from, you know. You never wake up from a dream marveling going, where did that come from? It's your own unconscious mind just figuring shit out. Interestingly, last week when I was playing video games for those few days, I had dreams. I don't get dreams. I never get dreams. Now, the reason I don't get dreams, well, I don't recall them. I probably do dream when I'm sleeping, but I never wake up with them. I think it's because I write too much during the day and I create too much during the day, and I think that tires out that part of my brain. So when I go to sleep, my brain doesn't need to remember dreams. But last week, I was getting dreams during the night because I was playing video games, and I think it's because I wasn't creating that I was getting these dreams. But I dreamt that there's this rapper from Dublin called Reggie Snow. He's a buddy of mine. And I dreamt that me and Reggie were outside my house and we found a spider web, and the spider web had lights on it, and we discovered that this spider web was connected to nature's internet, and it was sending light signals to all the plants, and they were interconnected with these lights because of this spider web. And then we got chased by someone who may have been Kiefer Sutherland, I'm not sure, because we couldn't tell anyone about the secret about the internet spider web. And I woke up from it. First thing I did was I mailed Reggie to tell him. But I woke up from it and I was kind of self-flagellating because I thought it was like an arrogant dream. I was going, for fuck's sake, man. You think that you and Reggie, now you're great artists and you understand the internet of the world, that no one can see you, pretentious cunt. Cop on to yourself. And I gave it a bit of analysis because I don't get dreams, so I'll have a think about it. And I was searching for depth, going, what does this mean? What is the spiderweb internet? And then I realised, it's the fucking plot of the video game you've been playing all week, you stupid cunt. Ori and the Blind Forest. The whole plot of the game is, it's like Super Mario, but you're in this forest and there's like this internet of interconnected light that gives the whole forest life, and that light is stolen by an angry crow and you have to reconnect the light of the forest. So that was my deep dream. I had rehashed the plot of a video game and claimed it for myself and somehow written Reggie Snow and Kiefer Sutherland into it. So that's why I won't be playing video games in 2018, because it'll fuck up my creativity. Usually around this point of the podcast, we have a little pause for an advert known as the Ocarina Pause, where I play my little clay Spanish ocarina. And depending on the algorithm, you will either hear an advert or an ocarina. Well, this week I've misplaced my ocarina. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere in that pile of jocks over there. But instead, what I'll do is I'm going to play a little bit of slide guitar, because the ocarina is misplaced. So you're either going to hear a small phrase of slide guitar or the ocarina. An advert, I mean. Sorry.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There you go. So what I'm kind of realising this week, based on the past 35 minutes of ranting, is it that a theme is emerging for this week's podcast. And the theme so far is that everything I've spoken about today, I've already spoken about in a previous podcast. Now, I don't want you thinking Blind Boy's gone mad, he's talking about shit he's spoken about before. Because I don't want to turn into Joe Rogan. You know, I like Joe Rogan, but you listen to his podcast and fucking, you know, Joe Rogan, he'll go on a rant about DMT whenever he hears a church bell. He talks about DMT every single podcast. And we've heard it before, Joe. And I fear that Flo is turning into my DMT. Which is ironic, because they both do similar things. Except one of them is internally generated. But no, I'm fully aware that I'm talking about topics from previous podcasts. But this week, I was speaking about Flo from a different angle, with a different level of interrogation, because it's something that's on my mind all the time. In keeping with this theme, there's somewhat something else that I'd like to revisit and reinterrogate and expand upon. And this is the colour blue. A few podcasts back, I spoke about Caravaggio and the economics of Renaissance painting, and how, you know, I had a hot take that the reason Caravaggio's paintings are mostly black is because he was trying to save money, because the most expensive colour was blue. Because blue came from the semi-precious stone lapis lazuli, which came from one mine in Afghanistan and was more expensive than gold. And this blue, this lapis lazuli colour, ultramarine, is the reason that Holy Mary was painted blue in paintings, because that's the most expensive colour. Paints are the most expensive colour. But there's something I wanted to speak about with blue that I didn't go into in the last podcast, because I didn't have time. But out of all the colours, blue for me is by far the most fucking interesting, because there is a hot, hot take. There is a very, very interesting theory about the colour blue. And that theory is that blue is a very recent invention. I don't mean the ability to paint it, but I mean the actual colour blue itself. The ability of the human brain to recognise the colour blue is only a couple of thousand years old. Do you remember back a few years ago in 2015? A photograph of a dress went massively viral online. And some bjor was buying a dress on fucking eBay or somewhere, wherever. And it divided the internet. The dress was blue and black. It was a blue dress with black lines. But some people saw it, myself included, as a white dress with gold lines. And when I showed it to my buddy and I said, what colour is this dress? And they go, it's blue and black. And I thought they were trolling me. I thought that there was, like, because to me, this dress was fucking, it was white and gold. It was white and gold to me. And my buddy saw it as black and blue. And I thought they were trolling. I thought there was some secret on the internet where everyone had spoken to each other. And it's like, if someone says that this is white and gold, just tell them it's black and blue. But no. Two people with sets of eyes in their heads were seeing the exact same thing in two very, very different ways. And it was flabbergasting to see that, you know? And to know that another person is seeing something completely different to how I'm seeing it. And it got people talking about the colour blue and researching into the colour blue more. And this conversation goes all the way back to 1858 with a boy called William Gladstone. The same William Gladstone who went on to become Prime Minister of Great Britain. He was a Prime Minister in 1858 while Ireland was a colony of Britain, so therefore he's automatically a cunt. But this is an interesting observation. So Gladstone was a bit of a scholar. And he went looking back into the famous book, The Odyssey. It's a Greek book by Homer. And I think it's about, I'm not sure, it's about 3,000 years old, 4,000 years old. It was written 800 years BCE, so that's almost 3,000 years old. So Gladstone started flicking through The Odyssey, written by Homer. Worth noting as well, Ulysses by James Joyce was very much based upon The Odyssey. Which ironically should make Ulysses a work of postmodernism and not modernism, in my opinion, because it was a pastiche of something that previously existed. But that's for another podcast. But anyway, while Gladstone was looking through The Odyssey, he started listing out all the colours that Homer was talking about, for whatever reason, I don't know. But Gladstone noticed that Homer did not use the colour blue at any point. Do you know what I mean? Like, he described the sea as a wine dark sea. Why not, you know, the blue sea? He was describing, Homer described honey as green. He described sheep as violet. It's like, what the fuck are you on, Homer? And it's very, very strange. Black is mentioned 200 times. White is mentioned around 100 times. And there's not that many mentions of other colours. There's a couple of reds, 15 times for reds. And then there's less than 10 mentions of yellow and green. But zero mention of blue whatsoever. So Gladstone, fair play to him, because that's, you know, 1858. That is some observation to be making. So he goes, what the fuck is going on? Where's the blue in the Odyssey? So he starts looking into other Greek texts. And it's the exact same thing. Nobody mentioned blue at all. The word blue didn't exist in Greek times. So then another lad called Lazarus Geiger, he started looking at what Gladstone was investigating and was like, fucking hell, Gladstone, what's the story, man? You're onto something. So Geiger starts looking at the Quran, ancient Hebrew versions of the Bible, Vedic hymns, and he said, These hymns of more than 10,000 lines are brimming with descriptions of the heavens. Scarcely any subject is evoked more frequently. The sun and reddening dawns, play of colour, day and night, cloud and lightning, the air and ether. All these are unfolded before us again and again. But there is one thing no one could ever learn from these ancient songs. And that is that the sky is blue. There was no blue. No book of ancient times mentioned the colour fucking blue. Ever. So when Geiger started looking more at, you know, texts, historical texts from all around the world, ancient texts, and every language seemed to first have a word for black and then a word for white, for like dark and light. And then those were the only words for a while, and then red came about to describe the colour of blood or the colour of wine, but still no fucking blue. Then yellow and green started to appear. But the last colour that eventually started to become mentioned as an actual colour was blue. And like the other thing too is blue eyes, human blue eyes, they're actually quite rare. They're only, first off, the gene for blue eyes, I think it's only about 5,000 or 6,000 years old. And there wasn't a lot of it hopping around the place in ancient Greece. The first culture to develop a word for blue were the Egyptians. And surprisingly, they were the only culture at the time that had a way to produce dye that was blue. They made it out of fucking, I don't know what they made it out of, but the Egyptians had blue dye. And then lo and behold, they had a word for blue. Now to us, we're thinking, what the fuck? Sure, look, the sky is blue. The sea is blue. This is evident. We can see this. But the theory is that, oh, if only the sky is blue and only the sea is blue, then you have no need for a word for it. If no other blue exists in your actual world, then why would you say something is as blue as? The other thing they think too is that people didn't actually see the sky as blue. They saw it as a form of white. And as mad as that sounds, take it back to that fucking dress that went viral on the internet. It's the same crack. I saw a white and gold dress. My buddy saw a black and blue dress. So it's, human culture needed to have a referent. It needed to have a label for this colour before our brains could actually fucking see it, which is insanity. But it's quite interesting then that, you know, in reference to the previous podcast, that blue then goes on to become such an important colour through the discovery of lapis lazuli, that, you know, this semi-precious stone that creates the colour ultramarine, which is a very pure blue, becomes the most important and most expensive colour in the history of art. That a colour that defined the career of certain artists. It defined the colour of the Virgin Mary. She was blue because that was expensive. And my hot takey mind cannot help but drift towards Jungian synchronicity. And whether this is a the significance of blue and its, you know, its place in human perception, whether is this a Jungian synchronistic event that it became so important then in our consciousness? Maybe that's just me talking out of my hoop. Probably is. But on a subject of, you know, human perception and paintings, another one in the history of painting and art that's quite interesting, I can't give you any reference to this because I didn't find this story online. This was, the bones of this story were told to me a good few years ago by my Leaving Cert art teacher, Christy McGrath. But it's an interesting story nonetheless. So this would have been around the neoclassical period, which I think is the late 17th century. And neoclassical art is, would have been dominated by a painter called Jacques-Louis David. You'd know David's paintings. He famously painted Napoleon. I'm probably off on the 17th century, could be 18th century as well, not sure. But anyway, neoclassical painting is, it's very realistic. It's shit hot. It's brilliant. If a neoclassicist painted a man or a dog, it really, really looked like that thing. It's very impressive, technical, academic painting. So anyway, was led by the French, and the French at this time were starting to knock around Saudi Arabia, which would have been, you know, a very sparsely populated desert land, populated by tribes of Bedouins and nomads, tribes of people who, they use a lot of horses. The tribes of Saudi Arabia got around on horseback. So the French were heading back and forth, I don't know, doing some colonial shit. And the French got quite friendly with some of these Saudi Arabian, or even around Iran, these nomadic tribes of horsemen. So these horsey lads, because of their geographical situation, they were Islamic. Now there is a, within Islam, there's a thing called aniconism. And it's a prescription in Islam whereby you can't create any image of a sentient being. You definitely can't. You cannot create any image of God. You definitely can't create an image of Muhammad. As evidenced recently by those assholes in ISIS who shot up Charlie Hebdo because someone wanted to draw Muhammad. But this is where it stems from. In Islam, it is forbidden to create or draw or visually represent any creature that is sentient and created by God, because it is seen as kind of arrogant. It's like, God created these things, who the fuck are you to draw them? So just don't. And this is why in Islamic art, it's geometrical shapes. It's like, if you look at, there's a place I go to in Spain called Cordoba, which has some wonderful Islamic art that's like 1100 years old, and there's no images of humans or animals or anything like that. It's just very intricate geometrical patterns, because it's the language of mathematics, and Islam believes that the language of God is the language of mathematics. So the respectful thing to draw are mathematical expressions, geometrical expressions. So anyway, these tribes of Islamic lads in Saudi Arabia around the 17th, 18th century, whose daily lives revolved around fucking horses, on horseback all day, simple as that. They know nothing more than horses. When the French were coming over, they tried to offer these lads some gifts. And one of the gifts that the French bought this tribe was a neoclassical painting of a horse. So like I said, neoclassical paintings are shit hot. If it's a painting of a horse, it's the best painting of a horse you've ever seen. So when they presented this painting to these Islamic lads, whose lives were nothing but horses, they could not see the horse in the painting. Like, literally. They tried to show them this amazing 2D representation of a 3D horse, and to their eyes, it was simply this mass of brown blurry shit on a flat surface. They were like, what are you showing me this for? What's so great about this? And they're like, it's a horse, it's a horse, the French were saying. And the Islamic lads were going, I see nothing, Shem. I can't see any horse. It's just a lot of brown. And the reason is because of the strict rules that these lads had in their culture about not representing, you know, not drawing anything on a 2D space, not representing an animal or a person on a 2D space, their brains had not developed the ability to read a 3D image on a 2D plane. They couldn't see it. They could not visually see the fucking horse. It was just a lump of brown. Isn't that interesting about human perception and brains? So just like the Greeks had no word for the color blue, therefore they did not see blue, the ancient Islamic cultures, who had never seen a 2D representation of a 3D object, simply couldn't see it when it was presented to them, because that's what the human brain does. Isn't that cool? The album I would like to recommend on this week's podcast is The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars by David Bowie. Now, that might seem like a bit of a basic choice, but I'm aware that people today, excuse the cough, people today well, myself included, we don't listen to albums anymore. And we might listen to David Bowie, but chances are, if you're listening to Bowie on Spotify or iTunes, you're merely picking the best of his tracks and listening to them individually. But I would ask you to go and listen to the entire album of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, because as a start to finish piece, it is incredible. It's a work of genius, and it should only be appreciated, I think, as a start to finish piece of work. It is an entire body of work with a narrative. So give that a crack and see what you think of it. Last week I recommended Swordfish Trombones by Tom Waits, which was met with a mixed response. And I can understand that, because it's Tom Waits' stuff. It's very challenging music, you know. Some people just want a nice slice of pizza. They don't necessarily want an oyster. His music is an oyster. This has been a rather ranty podcast so far, which is grand, you know. I'm back in form. It's 2018. There's nothing long. Nothing long with a rant. That's what's known as a Freudian slip, ladies and gentlemen. There is everything long with one of my fucking rants. 50 minutes long. But I would like to answer some of the beautiful questions that you'd asked me this week. Now, usually what I do for the questions is I'll go on to Twitter and I will say to you, any questions for this week's podcast? But Twitter was getting so overcrowded with responses that this week I decided I would ask the questions on Patreon, because there's a smaller audience of patrons on that who could ask it. If you would like to donate a few quid to this podcast on Patreon, please feel free to do so. You don't have to. Podcast is still going to go ahead, but if you enjoy it and want to give me, I don't know, €1, €4, whatever, please do. You will find it at patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. And what I'm hoping to do, because I've got a good few patrons now, what I would love to do is use the money that I'm going to get from it and maybe invest in a decent camera and a lighting setup or something like that, and have the podcast as it is, but maybe try and have a visual one as well. Do you know, have it as on YouTube, and I think that could be quite cool. Why not? But thank you so much, everybody who is contributing on the Patreon. Jesus Christ, lads. This is the first time in 17 years of my career that I'm actually earning money from the internet. Before that, if I was to earn money, it had to be going to RTE hoping that they'd give me a commission to write a television series or doing a bunch of gigs. But in all the time, we've never really earned a lot of money from YouTube, to be honest, because our highest grossing YouTube videos are on RTE's page. And Spotify earns your fuck all, and so does iTunes. So this is the first time that I'm actually earning a couple of quid where I'm going, that's nice, I can earn a living off this. So thank you so much to everybody who's contributing to the Patreon. To you, it's just like €1 or whatever, and you probably think it's no big deal. To me, like, it's fucking huge. It really, really is. And thank you so much. So anyway, I'll get on to a few questions from Patreon. Eric Fitzgerald asks, I'm reading the Gospel According to Blindboy. A lot of your stories are told from the point of view of a female narrator. Did you conduct any research for this, or did you simply disregard gender when writing these stories? There's 3 or 4 stories, I think, that are from the point of view of a female narrator. One story has no gender whatsoever. That was deliberate. The Bourneville Chorus, which I read out on a podcast a few weeks ago. Now, because I read that out, you automatically hear it in a male voice, but if you read it on the page, there is no gender in that story at all. I didn't want the gender in it. Because it's the only story in the book that deals with a sexual experience, and I didn't want to gender that sexual experience. I wanted the viewer to place their respective genitals on the character, do you know? And their finger in a banshee, and I don't know what genitals a banshee has. So just keep the whole thing no gender. Just whatever you want it to be. It can be male, female, or whatever in between. It's up to you. But for the few stories that I do have a female lead, what I kind of do, I mentioned a couple of podcasts back about, you know, at the end of the day, lads, like, look, I'm a man, and I've been raised a man, and I'm a straight man, and I've grown up with privilege of being a man, so I'm sexist. Do you know? I'm not a nasty, misogynistic sexist, and I really want to improve and try my best, but at the end of the day, like, do you know, my privilege gets in the way of, I can have some quite sexist views. Like, if I'm improving as the years go by through listening to women, but I can make quite a few sexist assumptions that are outside of my awareness because of the world of privilege that I was raised in. So because of this, I'm quite cautious when I'm writing for another gender. So what I do is I try and write with no gender in mind whatsoever. And then at the end, I will decide whether it's going to be a female character or not. That's what I prefer to do. If I deliberately write as a female, 5 minutes in, I'm talking about what it feels like to wear a bra. Do you know what I mean? It's just, I'm trying to shake that part of myself off. But it's good to kind of be honest with yourself about it, and then you can change that experience. So we'll say there's a story, a 10-foot hen bending with a female lead character. A lot of that is, the story is about anxiety, and a lot of it is my own experience with anxiety, with a few details changed. But at the end, I went back and I said, okay, this is going to be a female character. For Shovel Duds, the story about a murderer, I did want that to be a female lead. I really did. For subversiveness, because I wanted we do associate violent, murderous thoughts as being a male thing, so I wanted them to be a female thing in this particular story. But from the start, I said, even though this is a female character, I'm going to write it without a gender and then change it at the end. Also, as well, I had a female editor for this book, and that's something I specifically wanted. Her name was Catherine Goff. Unbelievable fucking editor. Gave me all the freedom in the world. And one of the first conversations I had with her was, if I send you anything and there's a hint of misogynism, there's a hint of sexism that I'm not aware of, please point it the fuck out to me and help me change it, because I don't want to produce work like that that's contributing to a fucking problem that already exists. So yeah, I try not to write gender at all. I'll change it at the end because of my own innate sexism that I'm not aware of. Marcus Dalton is asking, I'm some lad for sweet pastries and coffee when I'm hungover, but most people dig a big dirty fry. What's your comfort food after a night on the sauce? First off, I rarely will get hangovers because I'm a very good boy for preparing the night before. If I have a night of my delicious, beautiful zombie cocktails that I get in Pharmacia in Limerick, which are, they're strong drinks, do you know? The top of a zombie has got a passion fruit full of 100 proof rum, so there's a chance of a hangover there. What I do is, when I get home, I'll have 2 pints of water, 1 pint of Dioralite, and a banana, and then go to sleep. So when I wake up in the morning, I don't really have that much of a hangover. Then what I'll do is I'll have a fruit smoothie, and I'll go for a very gentle run. Not an intense run, but a gentle run. And that sorts out my kind of hangover. If I'm foolish and get so drunk that I don't prepare the night before, I don't know, I just roll around in pain and have a coffee and drink as much water as I can and feel very sorry for myself, and then probably order chicken balls and curry sauce. That happens once a year because I don't like hangovers, and I especially don't like the fear. People are always asking about the fear. What is the fear? It's like, oh, I'm feeling so depressed. Well, yeah, you took a lot of depressants last night. That's what drink is. I'm doing dry January at the moment. I haven't had any drink in, what is it, 10 days? Not because I feel I need to. just because I kind of want to, you know. A lot of people do dry January. So I just wanted to see, just to check in with myself, what would it be like if I didn't have, because I drink maybe, if not every weekend, every second weekend, but I thought, let's do it for a month, see what happens. Because I think it's a good way to check in with yourself. And at the end of the month, if I find that it was difficult, then I might have to ask myself a couple of questions about my relationship with drink. But so far, 10 days in, it's grand. Don't really have a craving for it and I don't really miss it. I also haven't smoked my vape in 10 days either, because when I got my little sore throat, I didn't really want it. And then I went, fuck it, I'm not craving it anymore. So I'm off the vape and I'm off the drink for 10 days. We'll see how long it goes for. James Coffey asks, you said before you have a great interest in cooking and food. Is there anyone in particular who you like watching or type of food you really enjoy eating? I love watching food vlogs. There's a guy called Mark Wiens, W-I-E-N-S, and he's on YouTube and he is a travel and food vlogger. And I love his videos. He travels all around the world and goes to cafes and diners and restaurants and street food, actually, a lot of street food. And he eats the food and films it. And I get a little bit of a podcast hug off watching those videos, to be honest. And what I love is, and his main shtick is that he has this ridiculous fucking face that he pulls when he eats food. This intense orgasmic look in his eye that you will either hate or love, but it's addictive. So I enjoy Mark Wiens. The Food Ranger is another YouTube channel. He's a Canadian lad with fluent Chinese and he goes up and down rural China eating mad shit, and I love that. I went on a little binge of Keith Floyd during the week. All his stuff is on YouTube. Keith Floyd was a chef and restaurateur in the 80s and 90s. And he kind of revolutionized how food was presented on TV. He was the first television chef to take food out of the kitchen. Food programs at that point were just some asshole in front of a camera in a kitchen cooking food. Keith Floyd was like, fuck that, we're going to Spain and we're going to make this dish in the back of a boat and I'm going to get pissed on wine. So if you want some entertaining free shit to look at on YouTube, anything by Keith Floyd. The man was a highly entertaining legend. Regarding cooks, do you know, I can't flaw Jamie Oliver. I really can't. Jamie Oliver always brings a little unique twist to any recipe he's doing. And when you copy a Jamie Oliver recipe, you do notice it. When you create it at home, you really notice, fuck me, this is different. That little addition of lemon that I didn't think would go into this dish, that really fucking works. Any type of food I like. Personally, I prefer to cook Italian, because Italian is very easily to replicate well at home. Indian, the same. Asian food, very difficult to replicate properly at home, especially if it's cooked in a wok. Woks require an unbelievable amount of heat. So unless you've got a jet wok burner, then forget about making decent Asian food at home. So I tend to stick to Spanish cooking, Indian, fucking Italian cooking. I'd like to say French cooking, but French, I don't know, French is nothing but a lot of fucking meat floating in butter. They can go fuck themselves. Lisa Murphy asks, how do you deal with panic attacks and extreme anxiety that interferes with your day-to-day life and work? Luckily, Lisa, I'm 10 years free of severe anxiety attacks. You know, I through the use of the daily and regular use of cognitive behavioral therapy, transaction and analysis, mindfulness, emotional intelligence, I'm anxiety free. And, you know, when I say that, when I talk about my mental health regime, just look at me like some fella who comes in and I've got a ripped body because I go to the gym all the time and eat properly. That's all it is. I have been mentally eating well and working out every single day for 10 years, and that's what's worked for me. So I'm free of it. But when I was in the throes of severe anxiety and severe depression, and I had to try and get on with my life, when a full-blown panic attack would happen to me, I did have certain techniques that I would use. The first thing that I would recommend you do is to address the way that you breathe. Chances are, if you're suffering anxiety, you'll find that your breathing is probably, a lot of it is happening in your mouth. When we suffer anxiety, we take these shallow breaths in our mouth, from our mouth, and it goes to the top of our chest, and we don't even know we're doing it. But your brain isn't, and your muscles are not getting enough oxygen. So try and focus your breathing as much as possible now. I mean, change how you breathe. To bring the breath in through the nose until you put your hands on your belly. And as you breathe in through the nose, slowly feel your actual stomach expanding. And that's diaphragm breathing. And moving your type of breathing from your mouth to your nose, where it goes deep into your belly, can very much reduce the levels of anxiety that you experience, because you're simply getting more oxygen. You're not getting those shallow, horrible little gaspy breaths that can go along with an anxiety disorder. The other thing you can do when a severe anxiety hits you, and you want to, if your panic attack is up at 10 and you want to bring it down to a 6, close your eyes, and I want you to imagine, do you remember when you were a kid in school, they had those washing up liquid bottles full of paint? Well, imagine a washing up liquid bottle full of black paint, 2 litres, big in your hands. And now imagine an A4 white sheet of paper. Now visualise you slowly pouring this black paint into the middle of this sheet of paper. And the black paint, very slowly and velvety, it fills from the middle of the page all the way out to cover the entire page in nothing but a thick, silky, viscous black paint. And the complexity of that image, it asks so much of your brain that it can de-escalate a panic attack from a 7 to about a 10. And I used to use that a lot. It won't solve your problems, but it will improve your situation, you know. So that's all I can say in that respect. Long term, if it's really fucking with your life that much, go to your therapist, go to a counsellor, access some of the free services, the charity services that are available. Medication might be an option. You know, I'm not anti-medication. It wasn't something for me, but everybody is different, you know. Give meditation a chance, see if it works for you. It may work, it may not work. I spoke about exercise last week. If you can go for a run, that's not a bad thing. There's many things out there that you can try and do. Cognitive behavioural therapy, you know, it's, I'm trying my best here, but at the same time as well, there is a sadness and a futility to doing this because of the lack of services that are available in Ireland. But have a crack at those things I just mentioned. The last question I'm only answering questions that got likes on Patreon, but I'm going to answer more next week. Dennis Limer, they're fucking great questions as well. Thanks very much, lads. Dennis Limer asks, what's the best gig you've ever been to, and which band artist do you wish to see had seen live? I'm not mad into live gigs, because doing gigs is my job. So, you know, like I've even festivals. A festival to me is just a big loud field. But the best gig I've ever been to, I was about 14 or 15, and I would have had very, very severe anxiety and social anxiety. So leaving the house for me was a fucking... actually, two gigs that I've been to were like this. But the first one that I went to, that was... this was at the height of me having agoraphobia. I couldn't leave my gaff. Going around the corner, going into school was difficult. But the Flaming Lips were playing up in Dublin somewhere, and it was before they were massive, so it wasn't, it was a small enough venue, can't remember what it was, it was about maybe 300, 400, so I went up to see the Flaming Lips with, my brother drove me up, because I just had to see him. I was listening to their stuff and I had to fucking see him despite my anxiety. It was one of the toughest trips I'd ever taken in my life. I remember having to stick my head out the window of the car up the motorway and vomit out the side of the car because my anxiety was so intense that I was actually leaving the house, that I was full-blown panic attack for the entire journey. It was terrifying, coupled with the fear that I was suffering from agoraphobia and I had to be in a crowd full of people at a fucking gig. But I went to see the Flaming Lips and they had visuals on screen which I'd never seen at a gig, and for that 1 hour of that gig my anxiety didn't exist and it gave me great hope. It was phenomenal. And then I puked all the way home then in the car and had anxiety on the way back. But yeah, the Flaming Lips, the second one a few years later. As you know, I'm very, very passionate about Bob Dylan. So when Bob Dylan, he did a gig in Galway and I was a teenager and I was like, okay, I have to be in the same breathing space as Bob Dylan. I have to do this for myself. I have to, despite my anxiety. And I had a very, very horrible time being in a massive, massive crowd. While I remember all my clothes just being soaked wet with sweat because my anxiety was so extreme that I was in this crowd full of people, terrified that at any moment I'd be crushed to death. And it wasn't even a good gig because Bob Dylan doesn't really do good live gigs. So that was awful, but at least I got to go home that night and go to bed and go, I saw Bob Dylan live, it's done. So I'm going to end the podcast on that note. Pretty positive note. God bless, not literally, metaphorically. Have a wonderful week. Enjoy yourselves. Look after yourselves. I hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. And leave comments in the review section on your respective podcast apps. Have a crack at the Patreon if that's what you feel like. And go in peace. Have a lovely week and look after yourselves. Next week, I'm going to London this week for some business with some tans. And I'll be back and I might have a few London stories next week. Yart.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.